You're listening to Radiotopia Presents from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
At 9 a.m. every Friday, I open up my front door to Michael Murat, a singing teacher with a stately baritone. We enter my living room. He sits down at the piano, and we begin our lesson.
Okay, so let's sing. So again, begin gently, really try to find with the...
Some days, I'll lay on my back on the hardwood floor with my knees bent and a pillow beneath my head. I'll take a breath, let my rib cage expand, release the back of my jaw, and begin to sing.
Good, so now... Don't misunderstand. Gentle doesn't mean key. There. Key. It's still going up. Yeah.
The reason for all this is that I'm about to graduate from music school. To do that, I need to present a senior recital. And to make that recital pop, I'll need all the help I can get.
The reason I sort of move... In through one and into the exercise.
All artists are part of a lineage of mentors and role models who help us understand our abilities and teach us how to create and emote. For me, there are four people in particular who have shaped my musical life, and in this episode, I'll introduce you to them. Because during this recital, I'll be channeling each of them, thanking them in my own musical way. My name is Matthew Schifrin, and this is Blind Guide Travels from Radiotopia. My parents realized that I had musical abilities when I was 2 years old. If my dad sang a melody or played it on the piano, I could sing it right back. So they took me to a music teacher, and it turned out that, like a lot of other blind people, I have what's called perfect pitch, meaning that I can hear a sound and immediately know what note it is, like C or C sharp, without using any kind of instrument as a reference point. It's as clear to me as the color red is to a sighted person. When my parents discovered this ability, they did what most Russian parents would do and started me on piano lessons. Trouble was, I wasn't disciplined enough to be a quality pianist. I didn't enjoy the process of endless practicing. And when it became clear that I would not be the next Glenn Gould or Yevgeny Kisin, they signed me up for singing lessons instead. My first teacher, Alexander, was a stern Russian bass. He didn't teach much technique, so I'd often come home hoarse from his lessons, but I loved it anyway. Alexander knew how to make a singer embody the music. Each of his students had their own signature song, and mine was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I entered my first singing competition at age 10. The competition was called Our Talented Children, and it was held at some tacky Russian restaurant in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn.
This may sound kind of crazy, but as I remember it, the stage was surrounded by wealthy observers who would place bets on which kids would advance to the next round of the competition. It's hard to know exactly what was going on, especially to a blind kid like me. At the time, I was too young to feel the pressure and stakes of the performance. All I could do was just get up there and sing. and it surprised everyone, including Alexander, when I won. After that first competition, I was invited to another one in the Dominican Republic called Caribbean Gold. My parents and I had no idea what we were getting ourselves into, and it turned out that this competition was essentially a beauty pageant for Russian children, with overfed contestants wearing gold chains and panicked mothers running around applying makeup or hair gel to their young virtuosos. I was billed as Little Bocelli and was all set to do a signature number, Time to Say Goodbye. The catch was that we weren't actually allowed to sing, and instead had to lip-sync to recordings we'd made. Time to say goodbye. Since I can't see, I didn't even know what lip-syncing was or why anyone would do it, so I just ended up flopping my mouth around, hoping no one would notice. I did not win that competition. I studied with Alexander for 3 years, but ultimately, he wasn't interested in the long-term careers of his singers. He was in it to give everyone a fun time, and once a singer's voice cracked, he'd find more kids to fill his ranks. So when my voice started changing, I decided to switch teachers, and I wound up with Norma Giustiani, an Italian opera singer in her 80s.
You lose that anchor, and then it wallows into someplace in the head, and you have it. The feeling is always right at the bones, yep. Or even here in this bone,
yep.
And this has to just be dead weight.
You know, I was hoping to interview Norma for this podcast, but sadly she passed away earlier this year.
That's all. And that's
I do have recordings of all our lessons, though, and they give you a pretty good sense of how she taught.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Let's get it right.
Okay.
During my first lesson with her, she made me get on my hands and knees and then sat on me as I sang the five main vowels. I, E, A, O and U.
Yes. You hear it? Tell me if you hear that.
Yes, I hear that.
This was pretty typical of her style. She would sometimes strap her students into a machine that flipped you upside down while you sang. Then, she'd put elastic exercise bands on your jaw to make sure it wouldn't come forward, and jab a wooden pole into your solar plexus to make sure your epigastrium wasn't tensing.
See, now I'm holding, this is the muscle that grabs in the high note, right here. See, feel it, near the carotid, right here. Put your hand here, let me show you.
Norma wanted to make sure that the larynx, the part of the throat that contains the vocal cords, was low.
The larynx. You see that, please? Go ahead.
So she would routinely hold me by the throat while I was singing. I'd come home with red marks on my neck as if someone had tried to choke me.
You can do it. Yeah.
I know this might sound kind of abusive, but Norma was truly committed to her students. She hung me upside down and grabbed me by the throat because all she wanted was to make me a better singer.
I'm just afraid of the heavy.
She put her soul into those lessons, and they really paid off.
No, despair is wrong. Love is wrong. That's it.
My voice became more flexible, and I was able to navigate the voice change unscathed. I studied with Norma right up to when I started college at the New England Conservatory, and that's where I met my third and current teacher, Michael Murat.
I'm an ex-countertenor and baritone. I'm a voice teacher. And then, of course, husband, father, and hockey coach.
Mm-hmm. could you talk a little bit about
the differences between teaching blind students as opposed to sighted students?
You know, I was thinking about this because it's an interesting question, partially because I have such a limited sample. I have you. And, you know, one very obvious thing that I discovered in teaching you is that for obvious reasons, you depend very much on the sort of physical feedback of the sound within you and about you. And unfortunately, as I spend time with sighted singers, that is one of the greatest obstacles too, is they cannot spend time trying to get feedback. Because that's a rabbit hole that you go down and it becomes something you're chasing as opposed to actually just singing. And so they don't fully appreciate the feeling of a sound or the sound of a sound the way you can when they're distracted by their eyes and the information it's giving. And that might be a fascinating thing to hear from you about.
It's an interesting concept. I've never considered sharing that because I just assume that kind of people, whether you have vision or don't have vision, you just kind of, you think about the muscles, you think about the notes, you just kind of prepare to make art and then you do it. I mean, of course, vision is a major source of information, but I didn't really think about it interfering with the singing as much as it probably does.
Well, you just have to see somebody who's engrossed in a bad television show and you call their name and they don't hear you to know that if the information you're getting from your eyes overwhelms the sound you're feeling. My first serious voice teacher, or I guess my second serious voice teacher, talked about feeling in a sort of loving way is not the right answer. An enjoying way, in an enjoyable way, the sound when you're making it. Now, that can be taken too far and get in your way, but I do think that the way you perceive the feeling of sound and arguably the oral feedback you get in singing would be simply deeper than mine would be, potentially.
A lot of singers talk about mentally placing the voice in physical space. Sometimes you put it in the front of your face, where your mustache would be, sometimes in the middle of your skull, and sometimes in the back of your head, behind your soft palate. Generally, though, I try to not hyper-focus on where the sound is in my body, but instead think of sound as a way to tell a story. If I'm singing a song about how beautiful the night is, I try to imagine a warm summer night by Lake Sunapee in New Hampshire. You should probably go to bed, but it's just so peaceful out that you want to stay there and revel in that silence. I've heard that sighted people have all these tricks for dealing with anxiety when they're on stage, like looking past an audience member's head or making direct eye contact with one person. Since I can't see my audience at all when I'm singing, I try to tune out the space around me and transport myself to wherever the music takes me, like that warm summer night in New Hampshire. And then, moving a little bit forward, thinking about the recital. Back to my conversation with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
What's your recipe? I mean, I'm thinking about this recital. I mean, sometimes you have singers who are graduating and they're just like, oh, well, this is my recital. I'm going to sing things and then they're going to set me free. And I really don't want to take that approach. I want it to really be kind of an engaging experience that really makes people kind of revel in the qualities of the human voice. What's your advice to make that happen? What concrete steps do I need to take to really make this recital impactful?
Right. Okay. Well, I think you want to have a balanced program that takes them on a trip, takes them on a kind of a journey. And that is one of my favorite quotes Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, who, of course, is well-known in song recital circles, used to apparently say to his pianist before he went out on stage, Gute Reise, which means good journey, meaning we shall go out there and we will take people somewhere and we will not be the same when we come off the stage, and arguably neither will they. And I think that's what people want. They don't want just vapid entertainment. There's lots of vapid entertainment in the world today. Feeling like you're taking somebody on a trip through a topographical landscape of joy and sadness and fear and angst and then resolution and apotheosis or whatever, you know, like that's a bit much, but you need to have something you want to share, something you feel compelled to bring to an audience. And when you do that, you are much more likely to be vulnerable in front of that audience. And those moments of vulnerability are what I will give my teeth for to see in a recital, to feel something.
For my recital, I'm hoping to take the audience on a journey through time. The first part will consist of classical music, starting from Vivaldi in the 1700s and ending with George Crumb in 1946.
At night, when everything is quiet,
the second half will focus on contemporary music.
Old house tends
Kurt Weill, Yiddish theater songs from the 1920s, French chansons from the 1940s, culminating in my own one-man musical called The Confidence Academy. This last piece will be the biggest undertaking of the whole recital, which is where my fourth teacher, Matti Kovler, comes in.
So, do you remember how we first started studying?
I actually do remember. I remember that your mother called me on the phone. We had a three-hour long conversation.
When I was in high school, I auditioned for the school cabaret and didn't get in. I went to the theater director after to ask for feedback, and he said I didn't get in because I was blind. He said it right to my face. Then, when I brought in the big guns, my mom, who had been in countless meetings with teachers advocating for my education, the director suddenly backpedaled and said that it had nothing to do with my blindness. My mom told him about all the other plays I'd been in and how the directors had adapted them for me. She even cited the law, which stated that blind students must be accommodated in extracurricular activities. But he wouldn't budge. The man just didn't care. Mom left the office and cried in the hallway. "Pick your battles," my dad always said. This one didn't seem worth fighting, so I gave up. On that teacher, at least. At the time, I was starting to study composition with Matti, and as it turned out, he was starting a theater troupe of his own. He invited me to act in it, and was more than willing to adapt the shows so I could perform in them. We traveled to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland, and put on interactive theater experiences in sculpture parks and art museums. It was awesome. Without those shows, I would have been a depressed mess in high school. And I've kept working with Matti ever since.
So first, I think first question should be, what are the differences for you between teaching blind students and sighted students?
I mean, since we deal with music composition, there's not a hell lot of difference, I think. It's more about creativity, development of musical imagination, and these things do not require visual sight. I mean, music is in our heads, in our brains, in our imagination, and also in our fingers. I mean, of course, when it comes to notation and using notation software, and this is where the challenges arise. But I think the common core is something that I actually get from my own teacher, Andre Haidu, which is no matter what you do, you kind of need to try to access the inner child in you and your students, and through this inner child, you can access many beautiful creative things.
My musical, The Confidence Academy, is loosely based on my own experiences at an independence training program for the blind. All told in song, of course.
Try that. Na, 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 na.
For me, writing music is mostly improvising. Once I have the basic lyrics and structure of a song in mind, I sit down at the piano, turn on a tape recorder, and let loose.
That's spicy, but not what we need.
It's kind of like fishing. You know that your goal is to catch fish, but you have no idea what you'll catch until a fish almost yanks your arm out of its socket.
That E-flat is flat, and it's...
Same with improvisation. You have a general idea of what you're going to write about, but the thrill is thinking of something on the fly and then having to stop the tape because you're laughing so hard. That's what the inner child is for me. Giving yourself the opportunity to be as goofy and ridiculous as possible without worrying about what you're trying to say or whether it'll work. Sometimes, it'll take me days to get to this place, and I'll have takes and takes that are just blah. And then, when I'm about to give up and throw my tape recorder against the wall, that energy, that anger, gets me going. And something hilarious or insightful comes up.
So you find him a job that looks gorgeous on paper, and what then? He'll burn out from the politics and stress. I'm just being realistic. Well, to me it seems sadistic. Academia is an option nonetheless.
Some composers will write their ideas out on paper, but Braille music notation is incredibly cumbersome, so most of my songs come together entirely in my head.
So where are we?
For me, a melody only exists as sound, not lines and circles on a page. In fact, many times, I learned a song from a recording, only to later discover that some parts of it were the singer's improvisation, not what the composer wrote at all. That line between composition and improvisation gets a little blurry when you can't see the music written out. For my musical, Mati, or one of my friends from school, will help me notate everything on a computer, based on the recordings I've made, so that my accompanist will be able to play along during the recital.
Bop. That's that.
The recital itself is entirely virtual due to the pandemic. I recorded videos of the individual pieces in the program, and then streamed the whole thing live via YouTube. So you're not going to be hearing any thunderous applause, but fortunately, I was able to get some audience members to record themselves as they watched.
All right, so this is an unusual kind of description since I'm not describing it with Matthew, I'm actually describing Matthew and recording myself.
You may remember my friend Ben, who I went to the movies with.
I don't know what to expect or what I'm doing, so in that sense, it's a pretty typical description.
Looks like this is about to start.
And Rachel, my gesture coach.
That's right, but I'm very excited, and it's so nice to see all the people who are watching this.
Olaf from LEGO is watching, as is Tatiana, my dating guide.
I'm not a professional musician, and I know very little about music, actually.
My parents, the whole podcast team from Radiotopia, everyone is able to tune in on YouTube for the big show.
1 minute 9, 8, 7, 6.
And all I have to do is press play.
3, 2, 1.
I remember as I stood in front of the Steinway piano in the recording studio, preparing myself for Vivaldi's Stabat Mater, I thought back to how Rachel and I had prepared for the TED Talk, and how we would identify the right gesture to make each moment pop. Then, mid-piece, during the most grief-stricken part, I slowly lifted up my right hand, moved it left, and placed it on my heart. holding it there until the next piano interlude came in. It was a small gesture, but it felt right. It was a movement with purpose. I like to think I channeled all of my mentors in this recital. Alexander's theatricality, Norma's technique, Michael's artistry, and Mate's gusto and creative energy. But I also know that they can only take me so far. As with any mentorship, you take what they give you, and then you try and make it your own.
They came to hear him daven, to give a sample. One was a leafhacker.
After we filmed the videos for the recital, I showed them all to Mati, my composition teacher, for feedback. His only comment was, "Why are you wearing that awful sweater?" Well, what could I say? Mom said it looked good on me.
Does he have rhythm? Does he have rhythm? Nobody can beat him.
The night before the recital, I stayed up late sending invitation emails. And in the end, there were 400 people there watching it live.
I've been waiting for this moment.
Comments started pouring in.
Hey, Matthew, congratulations.
Love those chords.
And I love the accordion.
It was so heartwarming to see all these people actively participating in the experience.
Oh, ausgezeichnet.
I think you could play.
Instead of sitting in hushed silence in a concert hall.
Bach is tapping his toes from the great beyond.
Wow.
My favorite.
Wow.
Matthew has obviously quite a vocal range, and I really wouldn't have known this is the same singer.
Fellow, but Comet in his teeth. Nutmeg in the washer.
Your best part was the third part when you were actually playing your own music.
Will I ever learn the secrets of adulting? How to cook an eye?
And you were totally alive and into it, and I can see the characters, and I love your accordion work.
Probably not. Why not? It's worth.
Well, very interesting.
Bravo.
Congratulations.
Thank you for coming. My goodness.
And I hope to see you again after this pandemic blows over.
All right, that's the
this
end.
This was amazing.
I can see that you worked
so
very hard during your years at the conservatory.
Love you. Wanted.
Once the curtain finally comes down and the thank you letters are all sent, there's a feeling of emptiness. I worked so hard to make this recital happen, and it went great, but it was fleeting, transitory. I guess that's why we keep performing, even if virtually, to feel that momentary connection with the audience. And as my singing teacher Michael said, to take them on a journey that leaves us all in a different place than where we began. Blind Guide Travels is written and performed by me, Matthew Schifrin. Our producer and sound designer is Ian Koss. Julie Shapiro and Audrey Martovich are executive producers. Thank you so much to our recital commentators, Ben Thompson, Tatiana Heiken, Rachel Kosser, and Olaf Gerlofsson. If you'd like to hear the complete recital, visit radiotopiapresents.fm. Next time on Blind Guide Travels, our final episode and my graduation day.
Blind Guy Travels is a production of Radiotopia from PRX and part of Radiotopia Presents, a podcast of limited-run, artist-owned series from new and original voices. Radiotopia Presents is supported by listeners like you. To learn more and donate, visit radiotopiapresents.fm.
Radiotopia.